I just knew something came into me that made me feel the water belonged to me. I would say, that's my water out there. I saw it turn every color. It was green one day, then brown, next day yellow as cider, purple, black, blue. It stayed restless, never ceasing. Boats coming and going on top, fishes underneath. I would sing these little verses to it. Cross the water, cross the sea, let them fishes carry me. If that water take too long, carry me on, carry me on. After a month or two, I was doing more things right in the house. But even Miss Sarah didn't know. Some nights, I left my post by her door and watched the water all night long, the way it broke silver from the moon. The stars shining big as platters. I could see clean to Sullivan's Island. I pined for Mama when it was dark. I missed our bed. I missed the quilt frame garden over us. I pictured Mama sewing quilts by herself. I would think about the gunny sack stuffed with feathers, the red pouch with our pins and needles, my pure brass thimble. Nights like that, I hightailed it back to the stable room. Every time Mama woke and found me in bed with her, she had a fit saying all the trouble there would be if I got caught, how I already lived too far out on Mrs. Bad's side. Ain't nothing good gonna come from you wandering off like this, she said. You got to stay put on your quilt. You do that for me, you hear me? And I'd do it for her, at least for a few days. I lay on the floor in the hall, trying to stay warm in the draft, twisting round in search of the softest floorboard. I could make do with that misery and take my solace from the water.
Sarah. On a bleary morning in March, 4 months after the calamity of my 11th birthday, I woke to find Hetty missing, her pallet on the floor outside my room crumpled with the outline of her small body. By now, she would have been filling my basin with water and telling me some story or other. It surprised me that I felt her absence personally. I missed her as I would a fond companion, but I fretted for her too. Mother had already taken her cane to Hetty once. Finding no trace of her in the house, I stood on the top step by the back door, scanning the workyard. A thin haze had drifted in from the harbor, and overhead the sun glinted through it with the dull gold of a pocket watch. Snow was in the door of the carriage house, repairing one of the breeching straps. Aunt Sister straddled a stool by the vegetable garden, scaling fish. Not wishing to rouse her suspicions, I ambled to the porch of the kitchen house where Tomfrey was handing out supplies. Soap to Eli for washing the marble steps, 2 Osnaburg towels to Phoebe for cleaning Crystal, a coal scoop to Sabi for resupplying the scuttles. As I waited for him to finish, I let my eyes drift to the oak in the back left corner. Its branches were adorned with tight buds, and though the tree bore little resemblance to its summer visage, the memory of that long-ago day returned. Sitting straddle-legged on the ground, the hot stillness, the green-skinned shade, arranging my words with marbles. Sarah, go. I looked away to the opposite side of the yard, and it was there I saw Hetty's mother, Charlotte, walking beside the woodpile, bending now and then to pick up something from the ground. Arriving behind her unseen, I noticed the tidbits she scavenged were small downy feathers.
Charlotte?
She jumped, and the feather between her fingers fluttered off on the sea wind. It flitted to the top of the high brick wall that enclosed the yard, snagging in the creeping fig.
Miss Sarah, she said, you scared the jiminies out of me.
Her laugh was high-pitched and fragile with nerves. Her eyes darted toward the stable.
I didn't mean to startle you. I only wondered, do you know where...
She cut me off and pointed into the woodpile.
Look way down on there.
Peering into a berth between 2 pieces of wood, I came face to face with a pointy-eared brown creature covered with fuzz. Only slightly bigger than a hen's chick, it was an owl of some sort. I drew back as its yellow eyes blinked and bore into me. Charlotte laughed again, this time more naturally.
It ain't gonna bite.
It's a baby.
I came on it a few nights back, poor thing on the ground, crying.
Was it hurt?
No, just left behind is all. Its mama's a barn owl. Took up in a crow's nest in the shed, but she left. I'm afraid something got her. I've been feeding the baby scraps.
My only liaisons with Charlotte had been dress fittings, but I'd always detected a keenness in her. Of all the slaves father owned, she struck me as the most intelligent, and perhaps the most dangerous, which would turn out to be true enough.
I'll be kind to Hetty, I said abruptly.
The words, remorseful and lordly, came out as if some pustule of guilt had disgorged. Her eyes flashed open, then narrowed into small burrs. They were honey-colored, the same as Hetty's.
I never meant to own her. I tried to free her, but I wasn't allowed.
I couldn't seem to stop myself. Charlotte slid her hand into her apron pocket, and silence welled unbearably. She'd seen my guilt, and she used it with cunning.
That's all right, she said. 'Cause I know you gon' make that up to her one of these days.
The letter M clamped onto my tongue with its little jaws.
Make it up?
I mean, I know you gon' help her any way you can to get free.
Yes, I'll try, I said.
What I need is you swearing to it.
I nodded, hardly understanding that I'd been deftly guided into a covenant.
You keep your word, she said. I know you will.
Remembering why I'd approached her in the first place, I said,
I've been unable to find...
Handful gonna be at your door for you know it.
Walking back to the house, I felt the noose of that strange and intimate exchange pull into a knot. Hetty appeared in my room 10 minutes later, her eyes dominating her small face, fierce as the little owl's. Seated at my desk, I'd only just opened a book I'd borrowed from Father's library, The Adventures of Telemachus. Telemachus, the son of Penelope and Odysseus, was setting out to Troy to find his father. Without questioning her earlier whereabouts, I began to read aloud. Hetty plopped onto the bed steps that led to the mattress, rested her chin in the cup of her hands, and listened through the morning as Telemachus took on the hostilities of the ancient world.
Wily Charlotte. As March passed, I thought obsessively about the promise she'd wrung from me. Why hadn't I told her Hetty's freedom was impossible? That the most I could ever offer her was kindness? When it came time to sew my Easter dress, I cringed to think of seeing her again, petrified she would bring up our conversation by the woodpile. I would rather have impaled myself with a needle than endured more of her scrutiny.
"I don't need a new dress this Easter," I told Mother.
A week later, I stood on the fitting box, wearing a half-sewn satin dress. On entering my room, Charlotte had hastened Hetty off on some contrived mission before I could think of a way to override her. The dress was a light shade of cinnamon, remarkably similar to the tone of Charlotte's skin, a likeness I noted as she stood before me with 3 straight pins wedged between her lips. When she spoke, I smelled coffee beans and knew she'd been chewing them. Her words squeezed out around the pins in twisted curls of sounds.
"You gon' keep that word you gave me?"
To my disgrace, I used my impediment to my advantage, struggling more than necessary to answer her, pretending the words fell back into the dark shoot of my throat and disappeared.
Handful. On the first good Saturday, when it looked like spring was staying put this time, Mrs. took Miss Sarah, Miss Mary, and Miss Anna off in the carriage with the lanterns on it. Aunt Sister said they were going to White Point, to promenade. Said all the women and girls would be out with their parasols. When Snow drove the carriage out the back gate, Miss Sarah waved, and Sobby, who was dandied up in a green frock coat and livery vest, was hanging off the back, grinning. Aunt Sister said to us, "What y'all looking at? Get to work cleaning, a full spit and shine on their rooms. Make hay while the mice away." Up in Miss Sarah's room, I spread the bed and scrubbed the gloom on the looking glass that wouldn't come off with any kind of ash water. I swept up dead moths, fat from gnawing on the curtains, wiped down the privy pot, and threw in a pinch of soda. I scrubbed the floors with lime soap from the demijohn. Wore out from all that, I did what we called shilly-shally, poking around up to no good. First, I looked to see was any slave in the passageway. Some of them would as soon tell on you as blink. I shut the door and opened Miss Sarah's books. I sat at her desk and turned one page after another, staring at what looked like bits and pieces of black lace laid across the paper. The marks had a beauty to them, but I didn't see how they could do anything but confuddle a person. I pulled out the desk drawer and rooted all through her things. I found a piece of unfinished cross-stitch with clumsy stitches. Looked like a three-year-old had done it. There were some fine glossy threads in the drawer wrapped on wood spools. Sealing wax, tan paper, little drawings with ink smudges, a long brass key with a tassel on it. I went through the wardrobe, touching the frocks Mama'd made. I nosed through the dresser table drawer, pulling out jewelry, hair ribbons, paper fans, bottles and brushes, and finally, a little box. It glistened dark like my skin when it was wet. I pushed up the latch. Inside was a big silver button. I touched it, then closed the lid the same slow way I'd closed her wardrobe, her drawers, and her books. With my chest filling up, there was so much in the world to be had and not had. I went back and opened up the desk drawer one more time and stared at the threads. What I did next was wrong, but I didn't much care. I took the plump spool of scarlet thread and dropped it in my dress pocket. The Saturday before Easter, we all got sent to the dining room. Tomfrey said things had gone missing in the house. I went in there thinking, Lord help me. There wasn't nothing worse for us than some little old piece of nonsense disappearing. One dent up tin cup in the pantry, or a toast crumb off Mrs. plate and the feathers flew. But this time, it wasn't a piece of nonsense, and it wasn't scarlet thread. It was Mrs. brand new bolt of green silk cloth. There we were, 14 of us, lined up while Mrs. carried on about it. She said the silk was special, how it traveled from the other side of the world, how these worms in China had spun the threads. Back then, I'd never heard such craziness in my life. Every one of us was sweating and twitching, running our hands in our breeches pockets or up under our aprons. I could smell the odors off our bodies, which was nothing but fear. Mama knew everything happening out there over the wall. Mrs. gave her passes to travel to the market by herself. She tried to keep the bad parts from me, but I knew about the torture house on Magazine Street. The white folks called it the workhouse, like the slaves were in there sewing clothes and making bricks and hammering horseshoes. I knew about it before I was 8. The dark hole they put you in and left you by yourself for weeks. I knew about the whippings, 20 lashes was the limit you could get. A white man could buy a bout of floggings for $0.50 and use them whenever he needed to put some slave in the right frame of mind. Far as I knew, not one Grimke slave had gone to the workhouse. But that morning, every one of us in the dining room was wondering, is this the day? One of you is guilty of thieving. If you return the bolt of cloth, which is what God would have you do, then I will be forgiven. Uh-huh. Mrs. didn't think we had a grain of sense. What were any of us going to do with emerald silk? The night after the cloth vanished, I slipped out, walked straight out the door. I had to pass by Cindy outside Mrs. door. She was no friend to Mama, and I had to be wary round her. But she was snoring away. I slid into bed next to Mama, only she wasn't in bed this time. She was standing in the corner with her arms folded over her chest. She said, "What do you think you're doing?" I never had heard that tone to her voice. "Get up, we going back to the house right now. This the last time you sneaking out, the last time. This ain't no game, handful. There be misery to pay on this." She didn't wait for me to move, but snatched me up like I was a stray piece of batting, grabbed me under one arm, marched me down the carriage house steps, crossed the workyard. My feet didn't hardly touch the ground. She dragged me inside through the warming kitchen, the door nobody locked. Her finger rested against her lips, warning me to stay quiet. Then she tugged me to the staircase and nodded her head toward the top. "Go on now." Those stair steps made a racket. I didn't get 10 steps when I heard a door open down below and the air sucked from Mama's throat. Master's voice came out of the dark saying, "Who is it? Who is there?" Lamplight shot across the walls. Mama didn't move. "Charlotte," he said, calm as could be, "what are you doing in here?" Behind her back, Mama made a sign with her hand, waving at the floor, and I knew she meant me to crouch low on the steps. "Nothing, Master Grimke, nothing, sir." "There must be some reason for your presence in the house at this hour. You should explain yourself now to avoid any trouble." It was almost kind the way he said it. Mama stood there without a word. Master Grimke always did that to her. "Say something." If it was Mrs. standing there, Mama could have spit out 3-4 things already. "Say handful is sick and you're going to see about her. Say Aunt Sister sent you in here to get some remedy for snow. Say you can't sleep for worrying about their Easter clothes, how they going to fit in the morning. Say you're walking in your sleep. Just say something." Mama waited too long, because here came Mrs. out from her room. Peering over the step, I could see she had her sleeping cap on crooked. I have knots in my ears that I can't undo, and this is one of the worst. The night I did wrong, and Mama got caught. I could have showed myself. I could have given the rightful account, said it was me, but what I did was ball up silent on the stair steps. Mrs. said, "Are you the pilferer, Charlotte? Have you come back for more? Is this how you do it, slipping in at night?" Mrs. roused Cindy and told her to fetch Aunt Sister and light 2 lamps. They were going to search Mama's room. "Yes'm, yes'm," said Cindy, pleased as a planter punch. Master Grimke groaned like he stepped in a dog pile. All this nasty business with women and slaves. He took his light and went back to bed. I followed after Mama and them from a distance, saying words a 10-year-old shouldn't know, but I'd learned plenty of cuss at the stables listening to Sawby sing to the horses. "God damn me, God damn me, day and night, God damn me, God damn me, all them whites." I was working myself up to tell Mrs. what happened. I left my place beside Miss Sarah's door and sneaked out to my old room. Mama brought me back to the house. When I peered round the door jamb into our room, I saw the blankets torn off the bed, the wash basin turned over, and our flannel gunny sack dumped upside down, quilt fillings everywhere. Aunt Sister was working the pulley to lower the quilt frame. It had a quilt top on it with raw edges, bright little threads fluttering. Nobody looked at me standing in the doorway, just Mama, whose eyes always went to me. Her lids sank shut, and she didn't open them back. The wheels on the pulley sang, and the frame floated down to that squeaky music. There on top of the unfinished quilt was a bolt of bright green cloth. I looked at the cloth and thought, how pretty. Lamplight catching on every wrinkle. Me, Aunt Sister, and Mrs. stared at it like it was something we'd dreamed. Mrs. gave us an earful then about how hard it was for her to visit discipline on a slave she trusted. But what choice did she have? She told Mama, I will delay your punishment until Monday. Tomorrow is Easter, and I do not want it marred by this. I will not send you off for punishment, and you should be grateful for that. But I assure you, your penalty will match your crime. She hadn't said workhouse. She'd said off. But we knew what off meant. At least Mama wasn't going there. When Mrs. finally turned to me, she didn't ask me what I was doing out here or send me back to Miss Sarah's floorboards. She said, you may stay with your mother until her punishment on Monday. I wish her to have some consolation until then. I am not an unfeeling woman. Long into that night, I slobbered out my sorrow and guilt to Mama. She rubbed my shoulders and told me she wasn't mad. She said I never should have snuck out of the house, but she wasn't mad. I was about asleep when she said I should have sewed that green silk inside a quilt and she never would have found it. I ain't sorry for stealing it, just for getting caught. How come you took it? 'Cause, she said, 'cause I could. Those words stuck with me. Mama didn't want that cloth. She just wanted to make some trouble. She couldn't get free, and she couldn't pop Mrs. on the back of her head with a cane. But she could take her silk. You do your rebellions any way you can.
Sarah. On Easter, we Grimkeys rode to St. Philip's Episcopal Church beneath the Pride of India trees that line both sides of Meeting Street. I'd asked for a spot in the open air sulky with Father, but Thomas and Frederick snared the privilege, while I was stuck in the carriage with Mother in the heat. The air oozed through slits that passed for windows, blowing in thinly peeled wisps. I pressed my face against the opening and watched the splendor of Charleston sweep by. Bright single houses with their capacious verandas, flower boxes bulging on row houses, clipped jungles of tropical foliage, oleander, hibiscus, bougainvillea.
Sarah, I trust you're prepared to give your first lesson, Mother said.
I'd recently become a new teacher in the colored Sunday school, a class taught by girls, 13 years and older. But Mother had prodded Reverend Hall to make an exception, and for once her overbearing nature had yielded something that wasn't altogether repugnant. I turned to her, feeling the burn of privet in my nostrils.
Yes, I studied very hard.
Mary mocked me, protruding her eyes in a grotesque way, mouthing,
very hard,
which caused Ben to snicker. She was a menace, my sister. Lately, the pauses in my speech had diminished, and I refused to let her faze me. I was about to do something useful for a change, and even if I hemmed and hawed my way through the entire class, so be it. At the moment, I was more concerned I had to teach it paired with Mary. As the carriage neared the market, the noise mounted and the sidewalks began to overflow with Negroes and mulattoes. Sunday was the slaves' only day off, and they thronged the thoroughfares. Most were walking to the master's churches, required to show up and sit in the balconies. But even on regular days, the slaves dominated the streets, doing their owners' bidding, shopping the market, delivering messages and invitations for teas and dinner parties. Some were hired out and trekked back and forth to work. Naturally, they nicked a little time to fraternize. You could see them gathered at street corners, wharves, and grog shops. The Charleston Mercury railed against the unsupervised swarms and called for regulations. But as Father said, as long as a slave possessed a pass or a work badge, his presence was perfectly legitimate. Snow had been apprehended once. Instead of waiting by the carriage while we were in church, he'd driven it about the city with no one inside. A kind of pleasure ride. He'd been taken to the guardhouse near St. Michael's. Father was furious. Not at Snow, but at the city guard. He stormed down to the mayor's court and paid the fine, keeping Snow from the workhouse. A glut of carriages on Cumberland Street prevented us from drawing closer to the church. The onslaught of people who attended services only on Eastertide incensed Mother, who saw to it the Grimkeys were in their pew every dull, common Sunday of the year. Snow's gravelly voice filtered to us from the driver's seat.
"Missus, y'all's has to walk from here."
And Sabi swung open the door and lifted us down one by one. Our father was already striding ahead. Not a tall man, but he looked imposing in his gray coat, top hat, and cravat of silk surah. He had an angular face with a long nose and profuse brows that curled about the ledge of his forehead. But what made him handsome in my mind was his hair, a wild concoction of dark auburn waves. Thomas had inherited the rich brown-red color, as had Anna and little Charles. But it had come to me in the feeble shade of persimmons, and my brows and lashes were so pale they seemed to have been skipped over altogether. The seating arrangement inside St. Philip's was a veritable blueprint of Charleston status. The elite vying to rent pews down front, the less affluent in the back, while the point-blank poor clustered on free benches along the sides. Our pew, which Father rented for $300 a year, was a mere 3 rows from the altar. I sat beside Father, cradling his hat upside down on my lap, catching a waft of the lemon oil he used to domesticate his locks. Overhead, in the upper galleries, the slaves began their babble and laughter. It was a perennial problem, this noise. They found boldness in the balcony the way they found it on the streets, from their numbers. Recently, their racket had escalated to such a degree that monitors had been placed in the balconies as deterrents. Despite them, the rumblings grew. Then, thwack! A cry. Parishioners swung about, glaring upward. By the time Reverend Hall mounted the pulpit, a full-scale hubbub had broken out at the rafters. A shoe sailed over the balcony and plummeted down, a heavy boot. It landed on a lady midway back, toppling her hat and concussing her head. As the shaken lady and her family left the sanctuary, Reverend Hall pointed his finger toward the far-left balcony and moved it in a slow circle clockwise. When all was silent, he quoted a scripture from Ephesians, reciting from memory.
"Slaves, be obedient to them that are your masters, with fear and trembling, in singleness of heart, as unto Christ."
Then he made what many, including my mother, would call the most eloquent extemporization on slavery they'd ever heard.
"Slaves, I admonish you to be content with your lot, for it is the will of God. Your obedience is mandated by Scripture. It is commanded by God through Moses. It is approved by Christ through his apostles and upheld by the church. Take heed, then, and may God in his mercy grant that you will be humbled this day and return to your masters as faithful servants."
He walked back to his chair behind the chancel. I stared down at Father's hat, then up at him, stricken, confused, stupefied even, trying to understand what I should think. But his face was a blank, implacable mask. After the service, I stood in a small, dingy classroom behind the church while 22 slave children raced about in anarchy. Upon entering the dim, airless room, I'd flung open the windows only to set us adrift in tree pollen. I sneezed repeatedly as I wrapped the edge of my fan on the desk, trying to install order. Mary sat in the only chair in the room, a dilapidated Windsor, and watched me with an expression perfectly situated between boredom and amusement.
"Let them play," she told me. "That's what I do."
I was tempted. Since the Reverend's homily, I had little heart for the lesson. A pile of dusty, discarded kneeling cushions were heaped in the back corner, the needlepoint frayed beyond repair. I assumed they were for the children to sit on, as there wasn't a stick of furniture in the room other than the teacher's desk and chair. No curriculum leaflets, picture books, slate board, chalk, or adornment for the walls. I laid the kneeling cushions in rows on the floor, which started a game of kicking them about like balls. I'd been told to read today's scripture and elaborate on its meaning, but when I finally succeeded in getting the children perched on the cushions and saw their faces, the whole thing seemed a travesty. If everyone was so keen to Christianize the slaves, why weren't they taught to read the Bible for themselves? I began to sing the alphabet, a new little learning ditty. A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Mary looked up surprised, then sighed and returned to her state of apathy. H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P. There had never been hesitation in my voice when I sang. The children's eyes glittered with attention. Q, R, S, T, U, V. W, X, Y, and Z. I cajoled them to sing it in sections after me. Their pronunciations were lacking. Q came out coo. L, M as Elm. Oh, but their faces. Such grins. I told myself when I returned next time, I would bring a slate board and write out the letters so they could see them as they sang. I thought then of Hetty. I'd seen the disarrangement of books on my desk and knew she explored them in my absence. How she would love to learn these 26 letters. After half a dozen rounds, the children sang with gusto, half shouting. Mary plugged her ears with her fingers, but I sang full pitch, using my arms like conductor sticks, waving the children on. I did not see Reverend Hall in the doorway.
"What appalling mischief is going on here?"
he said. We halted abruptly, leaving me with the dizzy sense the letters still danced chaotically in the air over our heads. My face turned its usual flamboyant colors.
We were singing, Reverend Sir.
"Which Grimke child are you?"
He'd baptized me as a baby, just as he had all my siblings, but one could hardly expect him to keep us straight.
"She's Sarah," Mary said, leaping to her feet. "I had no part in the song."
I'm sorry we were boisterous," I told him.
He frowned.
"We do not sing in colored Sunday school, and we most assuredly do not sing the alphabet. Are you aware it is against the law to teach a slave to read?"
I knew of this law, though vaguely, as if it had been stored in a root cellar in my head and suddenly dug up like some moldy yam. All right, it was the law, but it struck me as shameful. Surely he wouldn't claim this was God's will, too. He waited for me to answer, and when I didn't, he said,
"Would you put the church in contradiction of the law?"
The memory of Hetty that day when Mother caned her flashed through my mind, and I raised my chin and glared at him without answering.
Handful. What came next was a fast, bitter wind. Monday, after we got done with devotions, Aunt Sister took Mama aside. She said Mrs. had a friend who didn't like floggings and had come up with a one-legged punishment. Aunt Sister went to a lot of trouble to draw us a picture of it. She said they wind a leather tie around the slave's ankle, then pull that foot up behind him and hitch the tie round his neck. If he lets his ankle drop, the tie chokes his throat. We knew what she was telling us. Mama sat down on the kitchen house steps and laid her head flat against her knees. Tomfrey was the one who came to strap her up. I could see he didn't want any part of it, but he wasn't saying so. Mrs. said, 1 hour, Tomfrey. That will do. Then she went inside to her window perch. He led Mama to the middle of the yard near the garden where tiny shoots had just broke through the dirt. All us were out there huddled under the spreading tree, except Snow, who was off with the carriage. Rosetta started wailing. Eli patted her arm, trying to ease her. Lucy and Phoebe were arguing over a piece of cold ham left from breakfast, and Aunt Sister went over there and smacked them both across their faces. Tomfrey turned Mama, so she was facing the tree with her back to the house. She didn't fight. She stood there limp as the moss on the branches. The scent of low tide coming from the harbor was everywhere, a rotted smell. Tomfrey told Mama, "Hold on to me," and she rested her hand on his shoulder while he bound her ankle with what looked like an old leather belt. He pulled it up behind her so she was standing on one leg. Then he wound the other end of the strap round her throat and buckled it. Mama saw me hanging on to Benna, my lips and chin trembling, and she said, "You ain't got to watch. Close your eyes." I couldn't do it, though. After he got her trussed up, Tomfrey moved off so she couldn't grab onto him, and she took a hard spill. Split the skin over her brow. When she hit the ground, the strap yanked tight, and Mama started choking. She threw back her head and gulped for air. I ran to help her, but the tat-tat, tat-tat of Mrs. Kane landed on the window, and Tomfrey pulled me away and got Mama to her feet. I closed my eyes then, but what I saw in the dark was worse as the real thing. I cracked my eyes and watched her trying to keep her leg from dropping down and cutting off her air, fighting to stay upright. She set her eyes on top of the oak tree. Her standing leg quivered. Blood from her head cut ran down her cheek. It clung to her jaw like rain on the roof eave. "Don't let her fall anymore." "That's the prayer," I said. "Mrs. told us God listened to everybody. Even a slave got a piece of God's ear." I carried a picture of God in my head, a white man bearing a stick like Mrs. or going around dodging slaves the way Master Grimke did, acting like he sired a world where they don't exist. I couldn't see him lifting a finger to help. Mama didn't fall again, though, and I reckon God had lent me an ear. But maybe that ear wasn't white. Maybe the world had a colored God, too, or else it was Mama who kept her own self standing, who answered my prayer with the strength of her limbs and the grip of her heart. She never whimpered, never made a sound except some whisperings from her lips. Later on, I asked if her whispers were for God, and she said, "They was for your granny, Mama." When that hour passed and Tomfrey loosened the strap off her neck, she fell down and curled up on the dirt. Tomfrey and Aunt Sister lifted her up by her arms and lugged her and her numb legs up the stairs of the carriage house to her room. I ran behind, trying to keep her ankles from bumping on the steps. They laid her on the bed like flopping down a sack of flour. When we were left to ourselves, I lay beside her and stared up at the quilt frame. From time to time, I said, "You want some water? Your legs hurting?" She nodded her answers with her eyes shut. In the afternoon, Aunt Sister brought some rice cakes and broth off a chicken. Mama didn't touch it. We always left the door open to get the light. and all day noise and smells from the yard wandered in. Long a day as I ever lived. Mama's legs would walk again, same as ever, but she never was the same inside. After that day, it seemed part of her was always back there waiting for the strap to be loosed. It seemed like that's when she started laying her cold fire of hate.
Sarah. The morning after Easter, there was still no sign of Hetty. Between breakfast and my departure for Madame Ruffin's school on Legree Street, Mother saw to it that I was shut in my room, copying a letter of apology to Reverend Hall. Dear Reverend Sir, I apologize for failing in my duties as a teacher in the colored Sunday school of our dear St. Philip's. I beg forgiveness for my reckless disregard of the curriculum and ask your forgiveness for my insolence toward you and your holy office. Your remorseful and repentant soul, Sarah Grimke. No sooner had I signed my name than Mother whisked me to the front door, where Snow waited with the carriage, Mary already inside. Typically, Mary and I met the carriage out back, while Snow tarried, making us late. "Why has he come to collect us at the front?" I asked, to which Mother replied I should be more like my sister and not ask tedious questions. Snow turned and looked at me, and a kind of foreboding leaked from him. The whole day seemed strung upon a thin, vibrating wire. When I met with Thomas that afternoon on the piazza for my studies, my real studies, my unease had reached a peak. Twice weekly, we delved into Father's books, into points of law, Latin, the history of the European world, and recently, the works of Voltaire. Thomas insisted I was too young for Voltaire. "He's over your head." He was, but naturally I'd flung myself into the sea of Voltaire anyway, and emerged with nothing more than several aphorisms. "Every man is guilty of all the good he didn't do." Such a notion made it virtually impossible to enjoy life. And this, if God did not exist, man would have to invent him. I didn't know whether Reverend Hall had invented his God, or I'd invented mine, but such ideas tantalized and disturbed me. I lived for these sessions with Thomas, but seated on the joggling board that day with the Latin primer on my lap, I couldn't concentrate. The day was full of torpid warmth, of the smell of crabs being trolled from the ginger waters of the Ashley River. "Go on, proceed," said Thomas, leaning over to tap the book with his finger. "Water, master, son, nominative case, singular and plural. Aqua, aquae, dominus, domini, filius, filii." "Oh, Thomas, something is wrong." I was thinking of Hetty's absence, Mother's behavior, Snow's glumness. I'd sensed a moroseness in all of them. Aunt Sister, Phoebe, Tomfrey, Binna. Thomas must have felt it, too.
"Sarah, you always know my mind," he said. "I thought I'd concealed it. I should have known."
What is it?"
"I don't want to be a lawyer."
He'd misread my intent, but I didn't say so. This was as riveting a secret as he'd ever revealed to me.
Not a lawyer?"
"I've never wanted to be a lawyer. It goes against my nature."
He gave me a tired smile.
"You should be the lawyer. Father said you would be the greatest in South Carolina. Do you remember?"
I remembered the way one remembers the sun, the moon, and the stars hanging in the sky. The world seemed to rush toward me, sheened and beautiful. I looked at Thomas and felt confirmed in my destiny. I had an ally, a true, unbending ally. Running his hands through the waves of his hair, torrential like father's, Thomas began to pace the length of the piazza.
"I want to be a minister," he said. "I'm less than a year from following John to Yale, and I'm treated as if I can't think for myself. Father believes I don't know my own mind, but I do know."
"He won't allow you to study theology?"
"I begged for his blessing last evening, and he refused. I said, 'Don't you care that it's God's own call I wish to answer?' And do you know what he said to that?"
"Until God informs me of this call, you will study the law."
Thomas plopped into a chair, and I went and knelt before him, pressing my cheek against the back of his hand. His knuckles were prickly with heat bumps and hair. I said, "If I could, I would do anything to help you." As the sun lowered over the back lot, Hetty was still nowhere to be seen. Unable to contain my fears any longer, I planted myself outside the window of the kitchen house, where the female slaves always congregated after the last meal of the day. The kitchen house was their sanctum. Here they told stories and gossiped and carried on their secret life. At times, they would break into song, their tunes sailing across the yard and slipping into the house. My favorite was a chant that grew rowdier as it went.
"Bread done broken, let my Jesus go. Feet be tired, let my Jesus go. Back be aching, let my Jesus go. Teeth done fell out, let my Jesus go. Rump be dragging, let my Jesus go."
Their laughter would ring out abruptly, a sound mother welcomed. "Our slaves are happy," she would boast. It never occurred to her their gaiety wasn't contentment, but survival. On this evening, though, the kitchen house was wrapped in a pall. Heat and smoke from the oven glugged out the window, reddening my face and neck. I caught glimpses of Aunt Sister, Binna, Cindy, Mariah, Phoebe, and Lucy in their calico dresses, but heard only the clunk of cast-iron pots. Finally, Binna's voice carried to me.
"You mean to say she ain't eat all day?"
"Not one thing," Aunt Sister said.
"Well, I ain't eatin' neither if they strap me up like they done her," Phoebe said.
A cold swell began in my stomach. Strapped her up? Who? Not Hetty, surely.
What'd she think would happen if she pilfered like that?
I believed that voice to be Cindy's.
What'd she say for herself?
Aunt Sister spoke again.
"She won't talk. Handful up there in bed with her, talking for both of them."
"Poor Charlotte," said Binna.
"Charlotte? They'd strapped her up. What did that mean?" Rosetta's melodic keening rose in my memory. I saw them bind her hands. I saw the cowhide split her back and the blood flowers open and die on her skin. I don't remember returning to the house, only that I was suddenly in the warming kitchen, ransacking the locked cupboard where Mother kept her curatives. Having unlocked it often to retrieve a bromide for Father, I easily found the key and removed the blue bottle of liniment oil and a jar of sweet balm tea. Into the tea I dropped 2 grains of laudanum. As I stuffed them into a basket, Mother entered the corridor.
"What, pray tell, are you doing?"
I threw the question back at her.
"What did you do? Young lady, hold your tongue."
Hold my tongue? I'd held the poor tortured thing the near whole of my life.
"What did you do?"
I said again, almost shouting. She drew her lips tight and yanked the basket from my arm. An unknown ferocity took me over. I wrenched the basket back from her and strode toward the door.
"You will not set foot from this house," she ordered, I forbid it.
I stepped through the back door into the soft gloom, into the terror and thrill of defiance. The sky had gone cobalt. Wind was coursing in hard from the harbor. Mother followed me, shrieking,
I forbid it!
Her words flapped off on the breezes, past the oak branches, over the brick fence. Behind us, shoes scraped on the kitchen house porch, and turning, we saw Aunt Sister, Benna, Cindy, all of them shadowed in the billowy dark, looking at us. Mother stood white-faced on the porch steps.
I'm going to see about Charlotte, I said.
The words slid effortlessly over my lips like a cascade of water, and I knew instantly the nervous affliction in my voice had gone back into hibernation. For that was how it had happened in the past, the debility gradually weakening until one day I opened my mouth and there was no trace of it. Mother noticed too. She said nothing more, and I trod toward the carriage house without looking back.
Handful. When dark fell, Mama started to shake. Her head lolled and her teeth clattered. It wasn't like Rosetta and her fits where all her limbs jerked. It was like Mama was cold inside her bones. I didn't know what to do but pat her arms and legs. After a while, she grew still. Her breathing drew heavy, and before I knew it, I drifted off myself. I started dreaming, and in that dream, I was sleeping. I slept under an arbor of thick green. It was bent perfect over me. Vines hung round my arms. Scuppernongs fell alongside my face. I was the girl sleeping. But at the same time, I could see myself like I was part of the clouds floating by. And then I looked down and saw the arbor wasn't really an arbor. It was a quilt frame covered in vines and leaves. I went on sleeping, watching myself sleeping, and the clouds went on floating, and I saw inside the thick green again. This time it was Mama herself inside there. I don't know what woke me. The room was quiet, the light gone. Mama said, "You wake?" Those were the first words she'd said since Tomfrey strapped her. "I'm awake." "All right, I'm gonna tell you a story. You listening, Handful?" "I'm listening." My eyes had got used to the dark, and I saw the door still propped wide to the hallway, and Mama beside me frowning. She said, "Your granny Mama come from Africa when she was a girl. About same as you now." My heart started to beat hard. It filled up my ears. Soon as she got here, her Mama and Daddy was taken from her. And that same night, the stars fell out of the sky. You think stars don't fall? But your granny Mama swore it. Mama tarried, letting us picture how the sky might have looked. She say everything round here sound like jibber-jabber to her. The food tastes like monkey meat. She ain't got nothing but this little old scrap of quilt her Mama made. In Africa, her Mama was a quilter, best there is. They was fawn people and sewed applique same like I do. They cut out fishes, birds, lions, elephants, every beast they had and sewed them on. But the quilt your granny Mama bought with her didn't have no animals on it. Just little three side shapes, which you call a triangle. Same like I put on my quilts. My Mama say they was blackbird wings. The floor creaked in the hallway and I heard somebody out there breathing high and fast, the way Miss Sarah breathed. I eased up on my elbow and craned my neck. And there she was, her shadow blotted on the hall window. I lowered myself back to the mattress and Mama went on telling her story with Miss Sarah listening in. Your granny Mama got sold to some man for $20 and he put her in the fields near Georgetown. They eat boiled black-eyed peas in the morning, and if you ain't done eating in 10 minutes' time, you don't get no more that day. Your granny Mama say she always eat too slow. I never did know my daddy. He was a white man named John Paul, not the master, but his brother. After I come, we got sold off. Mama say I be the fair side of brown, and everybody know what that mean. We got bought by a man near Camden. He kept Mama in the fields, and I stay out there with her. But nights, she teach me everything she know about quilts. I tore up old pant legs and dress tails and pieced them. Mama say in Africa they sew charms in their quilts. I put pieces of my hair down inside mine. When I got 12, Mama start bragging to the Camden missus how I could sew anything. And the missus took me to the house to learn from their seamstress. I got better and she was in a hurry. She broke off and shifted her legs on the bed. I was afraid that was all she had to say. I never heard this story. Listening to it was like watching myself sleep, clouds floating, Mama bent over me. I forgot Miss Sarah was out there. I waited, and finally she started back telling. Mama birthed my brother while I was sewing in the house. She never say who his daddy was. My brother didn't live out the year. After he died, your granny Mama found us a spirit tree. It's just an oak tree, but she called it a baobab like they have in Africa. She say fond people, keep a spirit tree, and it always be a baobab. Your granny Mama wrapped the trunk with thread she begged and stole. She took me out there and say, we gonna put our spirits in the tree so they're safe from harm. We kneel on her quilt from Africa. Nothing but a shred now, and we give our spirits to the tree. She say, our spirits live in the tree with the birds, learning to fly. She told me, if you leave this place, go get your spirit and take it with you. We used to gather up leaves and twigs from around the tree and stick them in pouches to wear at our necks. Her hand went to her throat like she was feeling for it. She said, Mama died of croup one winter. I was 16. I could sew anything there was. About that time, the master got in money debt and sold off every one of us. I got bought by Master Grimke for his place in Union. Night before I left, I went and got my spirit from the tree and took it with me. I want you to know your daddy was good as gold. His name was Shaney. He worked in Master Grimke's field. One day, Mrs. say I got to come sew for her in Charleston. I say, all right, but bring Shaney, he my husband. She say, Shaney a field slave. And maybe I see him sometime when I back for a visit. You was already inside me, and nobody knew. Shaney died from a cut on his leg, for you a year old. He never saw your face. Mama stopped talking. She was done. She went to sleep then and left the story bent perfect over me. Next morning when I eased out of bed headed for the privy, I bumped into a basket sitting by the door. Inside it was a big bottle of liniment and some medicine tea. That day I went back to tending Miss Sarah. I slipped into her room while she was reading one of her books. She was shy to bring up what happened to Mama, so I said, we got your basket. Her face eased. Tell your mother I'm sorry for her treatment, and I hope she'll feel better soon. And it wasn't any toil in her words. That mean a lot to us, I said. She laid the book down and came where I was standing by the chimney place and put her arms round me. It was hard to know where things stood. People say love gets fouled by a difference big as ours. I didn't know for sure whether Miss Sarah's feelings came from love or guilt. I didn't know whether mine came from love or a need to be safe. She loved me and pitied me. And I loved her and used her. It never was a simple thing. That day our hearts were pure as they ever would get.
Sarah. Spring turned to summer, and when Madame Ruffin suspended classes until the fall, I asked Thomas to expend our private lessons on the piazza.
I'm afraid we have to stop them altogether, he said. I have my own studies to consider. Father has ordered me to undertake a systematic study of his law books in preparation for Yale.
I could help you, I cried.
Sarah, Sarah, quite contrera.
It was the phrase he used when his refusal was foregone and final. He had no idea the extent I'd enmeshed him in my plan.